Hello, listener. You are tuned in to Stems and Leaves, a podcast where we explore intersectional stories in STEM. My name is Emmy, and I'm your host. Before we get into this episode, I'd like to add a quick disclaimer. The opinions and views expressed on this show reflect the personal opinions of myself and my guests. We in no way speak for or represent any companies, organizations, or governmental bodies with which we are currently or have previously been affiliated with. That being said, I'd like to introduce my guest this week, Dr. Sujata Imani. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Good.
So this one is going to be hopefully better. Sujata and I recorded an episode a few weeks ago. We talked for like an hour and a half, had some really great discussions, but the audio came out horribly wonky, yeah. And there was no fixing it.
The universe was our director, and he told us to do it again.
So. Yeah, so the universe called a big cut on that and was like, redo. So here we are. I guess it's been almost 2 months ago.
Yeah, now? It was in June. June 11th or so.
Yeah, around June, at a meetup for 500 Women Scientists and Association for Women in Science. These are two groups that advocate for the empowerment of women in science, technology, engineering, math. They work to increase, you know, scientific literacy and all sorts of things around that, of which you, Sujata, are a pod leader.
Yes.
So it's wonderful to meet you and everyone else there. I actually met Shauna at that meetup.
Yes.
And she was last week's episode that went live. Oh, my scope of time is terrible, but very recently. So if you want to hear another person from that group, go ahead and check out that episode. But let's go ahead and get started first with a discussion on your identities. So would you share your pronouns and which of your identities are sort of the most salient in your work?
So I actually just recently learned about, you know, why people list their pronouns and how it's not actually for us. It's actually more for folks who maybe have different pronouns than other people think they have. So I was happy to learn that. So my pronouns, I think it's properly said as she and hers.
Mm-hmm.
So those are my pronouns. And I identify as mostly American, but I am of South Asian descent. So I'm Indian American. And I'm very proud of that. And part of the reason I'm very proud of that is because that's how my mom kind of raised me. She never kind of bifurcated who I was. She always tried to integrate those two identities that I had. Mm-hmm. So oftentimes Indian Americans that grow up in the United States, they kind of have this American me that they portray at school and then the Indian me that they portray at all their cultural activities.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I had that. I mean, I may have worn clothes or something that helped me blend in or something like that at mm-hmm. school, but as I got older, I definitely, you know, wore my Indian clothes. And actually, one of my prom dresses was Indian clothes.
Mm-hmm.
It was just slightly modified to basically look just like a gown, just like any of my friends had.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I've forgotten the latter part of your question.
So just, you know, that's, so your Indian American identity is very important to you. So how does that translate into your work? So you're talking about, you know, not finding yourself having like a school self and a home self. So I'm guessing there's not really like a work self. And then at home is when I'm, you know, wearing my sari, eating with my hands or, you know.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's kind of funny because I don't necessarily wear saris all the time. I certainly am more comfortable in my kind of westernized, I'm wearing jeans and a t-shirt right now. So I'm certainly very comfortable that way. But, you know, Indian clothes are really comfortable. Like South Asian mm-hmm. clothes are super comfortable. They're all cotton. And especially mm-hmm. in this extremely hot week we've had here in Washington, D.C., it's been nice going home and wearing just light cotton wear. So I have been wearing my Indian clothes a lot at home.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes if I'm going somewhere just with friends, like I'll put on basically Indian clothes and mm-hmm. go. If I'm having dinner with my husband, where we've been known to just go out in our best Indian attire,
mm-hmm.
Out into the middle of DC. And, you know, we don't really worry too much about that, about how we look, or we still speak our perfectly Midwestern English without any accent. I mean, as far as work goes, I guess the biggest part of being South Asian is that, and how it's impacted my work, is that I kind of am very stereotypical science nerd South Asian. So that's a big part of who I am. I am a scientist. I work as a AAAS Science Technology Policy Fellow at a federal agency. And so that part of me is certainly very South Asian, in the stereotypical sense.
Yeah.
But in other ways, I kind of broke out of that, because after I left academia, I went into the business sector, and then I went into patents. Mm-hmm. So I didn't become a lawyer, but I became a professional in the patent, in the intellectual property space. Mm-hmm. So there's kind of aspects of me that I definitely reminisce a lot about, of being a scientist, you know, thinking about great, great Asian scientists, and thinking about how even my Asian identity, or, you know, South Asian identity, might get misinterpreted by other people mm-hmm. as being X, Y, or Z. Mm-hmm. There's kind of that joke that, oh, whenever someone doesn't know how to deal with a computer, they kind of turn to the South Asian in the room or Indian person in the room.
Tech support,
maybe. Yeah, or like for a math problem or something like that. They're like, oh, you're a South Asian. You must be good at math or something like that. They probably aren't even as equipped to say South Asian. They'll be like, you're Indian. Don't your people know math or something along those lines? Mm-hmm. And I mean, I guess because my parents did, you know, bring me up in front of computers a lot, and I just got very familiar. Yes, I kind of fit that stereotype too, but I do wonder sometimes if people really see me and understand that I'm also a business professional, and I can also do a lot of communication type activities, you know, public speaking. And I don't want kind of that Indian American self, or rather, I guess, how other people stereotype Indians, to kind of overshadow my actual skills and my actual qualifications and and their ability to see me as an individual.
Yeah.
And I think that that's, you know, as I reflected more on, you know, I'm getting a second take at this. So as I reflected more about, you know, what that really means, I, you know, spent some time journaling, and that's kind of, I think, one of my kind of fears, as well as ways to kind of show people who I really am.
So let's talk about all of the things that you have done, which is a great litany of things. And in our last episode, our last recording session, we definitely spent a lot of time talking about that. So you have all of your degrees, all three of them, in chemistry and biochemistry up to your PhD. You've worked in research and consulting and patent writing and all sorts of stuff. So we came around to it last time. Just sort of, you want to share your highlights reel of sort of, let's do two this time.
Yeah.
Two highlights.
So I actually don't remember what my highlights were last time, so it'll be all new. Maybe it'll be the same, I don't know. But, I mean, when I went back and reflected a little bit, I really thought about, okay, what are the cool things I definitely share with folks? And I think going backwards, one of the cooler things I've done more recently is participated in an international innovation lab. That was incredibly eye-opening for me because, like I said, you know, my identity, I feel South Asian and American, but there, you know, I was less seen as a South Asian. I was more seen as American by all these folks from other places that, you know, maybe grew up in countries that had more issues with, you know, development and considered third world or whatever it is. But at the same time, you know, I remember that, hey, I'm Indian, and I go back to India often, and I do service there often. And I, you know, my aunt is a government physician, so she tells me the stories of things that she sees and people she experiences. And it was actually a great highlight for me because it reminded me that I still have work to do as an American to truly be understood, that I actually care and I'm not just coming in to like save the day.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I have to remember, and I actually remember this moment, that, you know, being an Indian and being Indian of Indian descent, that innovation lab took place over the Indian Republic Day. Indian Independence Day in August, August 15th, and so 15th, 16th, depending on what hemisphere you're in. And I actually know the Indian national anthem, and there's kind of the Indian contingent, the young people from India. And I thought, I was like, oh, I'm going to sing the national anthem with them, because they were asked to sing the national anthem. And I said, you know, I should ask first if it's okay with them if I join them. And they were actually really welcoming. They're like, yeah, if you know it, absolutely come sing with us, right? Mm-hmm. And I felt such, you know, unity in that moment, mm-hmm. right? So I think that's one of the things that made me feel really like, wow, you know, rather than coming in like, oh, we're going to create all these amazing technologies to save the sustainable, you know, or save these countries and do it sustainably. Mm-hmm. You know, in that moment, I was like, wait, I am a part of that, right? Like, mm-hmm. I'm not doing it for them. I'm doing it for us, yeah. right? Because so that was really important to me as I went back and kind of reflected on in my journals in that moment for a highlight. And then the other one is that, so I worked at a whiskey company, and that was super interesting and super intriguing for me as a scientist coming out of academia to work at a startup company and feel really skilled and valued in that space. But I think more than actually the cool company, I realized, I was like, yes, but that is a cool thing that we accelerated the aging process of whiskey, and it's a great product and it's out on the market and that's all wonderful. But actually, I think what it taught me and why it's a highlight is that I don't have to put myself in a box, and I don't have to listen to people who think I belong in a particular box, mm-hmm. right? When you're an academic person, it's like the only thing you ever are taught is how to become another academic person, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Like, you're just groomed constantly from the moment you pick, you know, after you leave your undergraduate career, if you choose to go to grad school. Oh, if you're going to grad school, then you must want to be a professor. And there's nothing else but being a professor. And therefore, you're going to be a grad student, and you're going to publish papers, and then you're going to be a postdoc, and then you're going to publish more papers. But now you have to try to get your own funding, too. Mm-hmm. And it's a constantly, like, hammering that into you. But then when I left, you know, partly by – it wasn't completely just my choice. I had some life stuff that came up that I had to take care of. My grandmother, and so I had to have a job that paid more than a postdoc did. But when I left, I kind of took this leap. Nobody really guided me how to be in the private sector. I had no real idea. Mm-hmm. But after I did it, with help from, you know, career counselors and whatnot, I felt that, wow, I've done this. I've completely transitioned, and I've really become a business-minded person with scientific chops.
Yeah.
Right? And even though I wasn't necessarily quote unquote groomed that way, from being a scientist from undergrad to master's to grad school, to my PhD program, I was able to adapt. Mm-hmm. And that adaptability is actually the highlight through this whiskey company.
Yeah.
Which that was a whole bunch of stories. I had to like figure out how I'm going to explain this to like all my cousins and family members in India who are like, oh, you know, she's going to be PhD chemist and working at a whiskey company.
So yeah, a bit of a 180.
Yeah, it's definitely expected. Not what people expect a South Asian, a 20-something year old South Asian girl to do. Mm-hmm. Work at a very male dominated whiskey company. But it was what I think I really got from it, what I learned from it about mm-hmm. myself that makes it a highlight.
So another thing I wanted to ask you, last time we spoke, I asked sort of about your upbringing and concerns to your culture. And something that you spoke on was this sense of fearlessness that you inherited from your mother.
Yeah.
That's sort of driven you and given you a confidence to move forward despite being the minority in STEM. And sort of referring back to what we've been talking about, you know, feeling like, oh, as a South Asian person, they'll expect me to be this way or that way, or maybe I have to, you know, act white at school, act white in the workplace, mm-hmm. and then at home I can have my curry and my roti. So do you want to speak on that a little bit?
Yeah. My mom was, and I say was because she's passed away, she was fearless herself. I mean, I think everyone should understand that anybody who has immigrant parents or you know, who is an immigrant themselves, they've gone through a lot to be here, mm-hmm. right? It's not easy to be able to come to the States in general. I mean, yes, maybe it's even harder now to some extent than it was in the 80s when my parents came, but it's got to be scary to, you know, go thousands and thousands of miles away from everything you know, everything you grew up with, all your family members, and be the first person in your family in a brand new country. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that being said, my mom actually had an education in computer science in India, in engineering, actually, electrical engineering. But when she came here, those credentials mattered zero, right? And even though she went to some of the best schools in India and was literally kind of like a, you know, here we have like a national scholar, like some presidential medals for academics. Yeah. She received one of those in India. Mm-hmm. And it's not like, you know, hundreds of people receive them. Like very few people per state in India receive these medals, right? Mm-hmm. And she went from being, you know, a faculty member at one of the best universities, you know, the IITs, which is Indian Institutes of Technology. Mm-hmm. And when my dad was here and then brought her here, he was allowed to have a career because he had the proper visas and whatnot, but she was not. Mm-hmm. And so she went from being like a lecturer, very well known, very well respected, to being just another Indian woman here in America. And I was three at that time when we came, but you know, she was never perfectly happy just staying at home without that other component of her life that was really important to her. So, you know, fast forward a little bit of time, she went and got another master's, right? Mm-hmm. And at that point, my parents had been divorced. And the Indian community here or in India is not kind to divorcees, and certainly wasn't in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. Was not kind to divorcees' kids either. Mm-hmm. So a lot of, you know, what my mom tried to instill in us was that, you know, not to the extent that she was ignoring the fact that we were being maybe hurt by our, you know, cultural friends and whatnot, but she was like, you know what, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter who your friends are. It doesn't matter if they choose to play with you or this other group chooses to play with you. Go and play, right? Go and be with people. And she also adapted that for herself. You know, it's hard. You know, she had an accent and she maybe didn't have the best Western clothes styles and whatnot. It was hard for her to get along at work and try to make that her own space, mm-hmm. right? That new space, her own space. And I think over the years, as I watched her, I was kind of like, wow, you know, like, yeah, we fought. Yeah, we, you know, we were, you know, teenagers and teenage girls and their moms, like we fight, right?
Yeah.
And we did. But the thing was, is that my mom, she still like remained so clear about, you know, not worrying about, you know, how we were being treated maybe outside the house, not worrying about how people would look at us in a different way or whatever. She would just say, you know, be who you want to be, right? She would made it very clear that even though we'd have pizza parties or whatever for our birthdays with my friends, whoever chose to came over, she would also say, yes, but we're always going to have Indian food, right? And when you're a kid, you're like, oh, Indian food is pungent. If you have never tried it, it's, you know, lots of garlic and ginger and onions and spices. And, you know, at that time, Indian restaurants weren't like on every corner like they are maybe now, or maybe not even every corner, but every city, no matter how rural, seems to have at least an Indian restaurant or something like that, right? And it was definitely not like that. And I didn't grow up in a rural place. I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, right? So, but even then, even though they had lots of Indian folks at that time too, with lots of engineering firms and such in the area, there wasn't that acceptance, right?
Yeah.
So, but my mom just said, you know, we have to just be who we are. We're not going to change everything about ourselves, right? To exist. And I remember even at school, you know, she was very clear that like, hey, you know, you'll get an allowance, but that allowance you have to use for whatever you want at school. If you don't want to eat the food at home, you don't want to take that food from home, then here's your allowance. You figure it out. Mm-hmm. Right. And so that was very clear from the beginning that like, you know, nothing is free, but there's no reason to do things out of shame, right? There's no need to overextend yourself because you think it'll buy you some acceptance.
Yeah.
Right. And I think like that was the same for her. So after my sister and I got a little bit older, my mom was this got this nickname eventually called Woman of Massive Determination, right? Because she was a WMD, and this is post the George W. Bush era. Some of you may be old enough to remember where he, you know, his weapons of mass destruction in a certain part of the world, and he wanted to go and attack. So we turned that around on its head, or somebody turned that around on its head and called my mom a woman of massive determination, so a WMD for us, right?
I love that. And so
my mom was like this 5'2", somewhat portly, you know, Indian lady who would come to, you know, nonprofit meetings and board meetings and, you know, commemorative days that the mayor of Cleveland or a senator from Ohio would invite the Indian cultural organizations to come to. And she would walk right up there, you know, with all these Indian American men in their business suits, like Western business suits. And she'd be in her best sari and wearing, you know, her complete Indian outfit, right? Not worrying about what they're wearing or what is quote unquote expected of her to wear in this, oh, very, you know, it's the mayor's gala or whatever. She would rock right up to the mayor and, you know, shake their hand. And so she had this like great melding of like, I can be a business person, I can, or a business minded person, you know, in that professional context and still be in my sari and still wow people and walk up on stage and talk about Indian culture and how it's actually so related to some aspects of Cleveland history. And it, and there is, there's lots of parallels and interactions between India and Cleveland history. But she would just do that. And people were just like, who is this lady? Like, what is her name? Like, why is she up there? And people just like loved her. And just in the sense of, I don't want to say make it sound like she's some celebrity, but I think they were enamored with this fact that she did not adhere to those quote unquote norms. And I think that that's, again, was this visually or you know, she walked that walk, right? She didn't just tell me to be fearless. She didn't just tell me what to do. She was doing it. And I think that attitude definitely spilled over into mine and my sister's life. And we also owned our Indianness, I guess, to some extent. Like my, whether it be my birthday parties or whatever, you know, you dress up for your birthday. Well, I wore Indian clothes when I dressed up. You know, and that, like I said, my prom dress was, you know, a slightly modified Indian clothes. So, you know, she gave me that fearlessness to be creative and to just be myself and to be comfortable, whether it be what I was eating, what I was wearing, how I was speaking, how I tied my hair, all of those things.
But something that definitely I haven't been able to bring up on the show, or I haven't had someone who would be willing to share. And you've alluded to, as we're discussing here anyways, several years ago, your mother passed away and something that you were sort of thrust into that changed your life path very much was that you were made to be a caretaker for your grandmother. And when we talk about identities, I think a lot of people kind of think of things that we're born into, like, we are born into brown skin, and that is who we are. If you are LGBTQ, you didn't pick that. That's just who you are. But your identity as a caretaker was not something you chose for yourself. But it has changed your life and your career path and pretty much everything you've done since that point significantly. So would you want to share about that?
Yeah, I can definitely do that. And I guess I regret not saying that that was also part of my identity, because I think that, you know, it's easy to say your identity because, you know, even mathematically, identity means, you know, one-to-one, like something that matches, right? And maybe to some extent, you know, what we imagine ourselves to be doesn't always exactly match what we're actually doing in life. And so we're always striving for what we imagine ourselves to be, right? But maybe we need to change our imagination and, you know, make our reality it and commit more to that. And I think that's kind of what, you know, becoming, you know, my grandmother's guardian, you know, instantaneously when my mom died, basically, to recommitting how life is lived, right? So I think when, you know, we're young, we're on our own, and, you know, my mom wanted me to be independent and by myself and all that stuff and, you know, drive my own life choices and career path and all of those things. And she certainly didn't expect to die. She died in an accident. So, but, you know, when I became responsible for my grandmother, it took a while for me to start accepting that. I won't say it didn't. It sucked a lot because I was in grad school and I was like 20. I was 25 and I was hanging out all weekend long. Like, you know, I go to work. We work really hard during the week at lab, and you know, I would go to lab even on the weekends. But certainly every night, I was like out with my friends and eating dinner and making dinner and drinking and having a good time, right? And I'd never done that in undergrad. I worked so hard in undergrad and my master's that, you know, grad school, I felt like, oh well, you work so many hours. There really is no more work you can do at certain hours because your cells are growing, you know, being a biochemist, right? Yeah. The cells have to grow. What can I do? So you go and hang out with your friends and party and have a good time, right? And I mean, instantaneously, all that changed, right? I was literally at lab and, you know, got a call and, you know, stopped everything. I think I left the microscope on that was running up an experiment or something and left to Cleveland. I was in San Diego. And, you know, how that changes your mindset, it's hard to accept. Because like I'm saying, like you imagine your life one way, you're living it in one way, and initially you all of that lines up, and then some dramatic thing happens, and everything's out of alignment again. And that's where you feel all this tension and anger and frustration, and you know, whoever's around you, unfortunately, will get the brunt of that, you know? And at the same time, though, I kind of had a, for lack of a better metaphor, come to Jesus moment. Like, hey, she's here. She also didn't choose, my grandmother, she's here. She also didn't choose this. She would give anything not to have my mom have died that day, right? And you know, as crappy as I'm feeling, she had to outlive her kid, right? And so I started to think like, you know, what am I bitching about, right? Like, what am I lacking? Like, some people don't ever get independence because their parent or their sibling or something is really sick and they need to be there all the time with their family. I got to go away for college. I got to go away for quite a while for grad school. I'm living in San Diego. Like, okay, this is the circumstance, right? And like being able to kind of face that, you know, kind of like a brick wall, but you face it and it is hard and it did change me. And so becoming that caregiver, you know, whether it be a small child or an older person, there's lots of similarities. My grandmother can't drive by herself. She never lived by herself, really. She always had someone around her. Like, pretty much she went from being a young person to being married, and then being a parent, being a grandparent. And like now, again, she, you know, she's back in this circumstance of like, she's my grandparent, but she still needs a lot of help. She can't really do a lot of things by herself. So the main thing I had to change is, you know, I went to grad school, I finished my graduate studies, I finished my PhD, and then it was like, okay, decision time, like how, what am I going to do for work, right, after your graduate program. All my friends were moving to San Francisco, you know, getting postdocs or getting some, you know, gig at Genentech or some big biotech company or something. But I was like, I can't afford to live in San Francisco. How can I support me and her in San Francisco? I can barely make it work in San Diego. And I said also, like, it's not good for her in San Francisco. What's she going to do there? It's all hills. She can't walk, right? She won't, I don't have any real close family. What is she going to do, right? And so these kind of decisions where you start to have to realize, like, what's really important? Right? What's really important? And in that circumstance, she had given up so much of her independence and her life for the existence of her kids and her family, me. Like, she only had an eighth grade education. How did my mom have a master's and I have a PhD? It was only because she valued our education so much, because she lacked it. Right? And it wasn't her choice, right, at that time. And so I was like, I'm giving up a city and a particular kind of job I can just as well trade that for a different city and a different kind of job. And for the most part, I'm still getting the greater part of what I think I want for myself. But what I've added is that I'm giving her a whole different, you know, opportunity to exist now without my mom, which she never really knew that life for a long time, right? Mm-hmm. So, well, yeah, 51 years, that's when my mom, like, existed, right? So, you know, it was a practice in humility. It was a practice in, you know, I practice Hinduism, and so it was a practice in reducing my ego, which is very important in Hinduism. And it's not exactly the same as humility, because humility is almost like somewhat, you can say, is kind of temporary, but reducing your ego is supposed to be like a permanent thing, like really making sure your ego is not flaring up. And when I say ego, I mean that identification with what I want and what I need and what I worked for, right? Mm-hmm. It's that attitude that who cares about anybody else, right? Mm-hmm. If I'm not getting what I want, why am I in this? And that's not, I think, as humans, how we're supposed to be. I mean, even with our original tribal cultures, it's not the kind of survival that worked for most tribes.
Yeah, we survived because we built strong communities and support each other. We go as slow as the weakest one.
Yeah, yeah, and that kind of mutualism, mm-hmm. right? Where I'm dependent on you, but you're dependent on me. And everybody has to survive and get what they need.
So the last kind of question I have, we're going to pivot back toward the STEM topics. You are a policy fellow with the American Association for the Advancement of the Sciences, AAAS, as we will refer to it from here on out in the podcast. And I think we already have.
Yeah.
And you are assigned with the Department of Energy. And you work sort of in this juncture of communicating between scientists and policy people and explaining to each of these groups how to do the cooperation better.
Yeah, sort of. So many of us AAAS fellows have kind of multiple roles, or different roles, I should say. Some of us are very focused on the communication aspect of helping either congressional staffers or congresspeople understand science. That's one aspect, like translating from the science to, you know, congressional speak. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that has to do with money and explaining why it takes such and such amount of money to do such and such things.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's just about the results. Like, why is this particular scientific study important? Mm-hmm. Right? So, you know, why are we studying amphibians instead of people? Right? Mm-hmm. Some people argue these things. And it's like, well, those are model organisms, right? You don't want to put certain things in people before testing it in certain organisms.
Yeah.
I mean, it could be something as simple as that. But the other part of what we're learning as fellows is how to connect to people, mm-hmm. right? And so some of us are really good at telling a story and connecting about grandparents or someone who you've had in your family that's sick and why that motivated you to be in science. Mm-hmm. Similarly, sharing science stories in that way helps Congress people understand, right? Mm-hmm. Helps anybody, actually. Helps anyone in the general public understand science mm-hmm. better. The other half, which is a little bit more of what I'm doing, is making sure that whatever the policies that have been created, mm-hmm. we put those to best use in science.
Okay.
Right? So I'm in what's called a funding office. So the Department of Energy is actually mostly a funding agency. It's not a regulatory agency, mm-hmm. Unlike the EPA, right? The mm-hmm. Environmental Protection Agency. Mm-hmm. We don't regulate anything. We actually mostly give money out for research into energy topics.
Okay.
So the group I'm at works on biofuels and bioproducts and trying to make things that go into plastics, for example, mm-hmm. in a more sustainable way. Mm-hmm. So instead of right now, how we do it is getting petroleum is used for both gasoline and cars, mm-hmm. as well as to make plastics. Well, what if we could just use petroleum for gasoline and cars, but make the plastics out of something else that we can actually refine from plants? Or mm-hmm. we can get microbes to make those products for us, those polymers for us.
Yeah.
So we're trying to make that sorry, let me say it more correctly. We're trying to help fund and, you know, steward the money toward things that can do mm-hmm. things like that. So when I say we, I do not represent the Department of Energy. Mm-hmm. I am just a fellow. Nothing I say represents the Department of Energy. Mm-hmm. But I'm learning about that. Right? Yeah. And that's what I'm trying to understand. And I'm also trying to help scientists out in the national lab system, which are amazing. And if anybody here doesn't know about the national labs, please look them up. I did not know about them. And who knows, if I had known about them, maybe I wouldn't have had to leave science, because they tend to be in remote locations that are cheap to live in. Mm-hmm. And I probably might have been able to do a postdoc at a national lab instead of leave academia. But anyways, if you don't know what the national labs, please look them up.
I'll add some links in the description, so yes, you have no excuse yes, to look yes, at yes. it.
Please look them up. They're great places, and especially if you like team-based science and maybe you felt isolated in grad school or undergrad, mm-hmm. it's a great place to look for interesting projects that are team-based and not so individual mm-hmm. as some university programs are. But that being said, so I've gotten to work with some amazing scientists at National Labs, learn about amazing, huge projects that only the National Lab system can really do, because they're just such large-scale projects that one university, one lab can't yeah. do it. So you have to have these massive teams of people working toward a particular vision and goal. Mm-hmm. So, for example, you know, some of the things that the DOE in our office we work on is trying to understand climate systems, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't mean, you know, weather. Weather is what NOAA does, mm-hmm. National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration. But we're talking about climate. So how weather patterns can be predicted, mm-hmm. right? So how do we know that, you know, certain effects like El Nino and La Nina, and how are they going to affect certain rainfall and maybe other areas or something? Like, mm-hmm. we're trying to get that predictive understanding. We don't have it yet, and it's mm-hmm. an extremely complex set of circumstances that we're trying to understand, mm-hmm. but those kinds of ideas. Yeah. The thing is, you know, like I said, biofuels and bioproducts. Well, how can we engineer microbes, and how can we maybe engineer plants to do those things for us? And how can we do it safely so that they don't get out into the environment and do some harm, right? Mm-hmm. We don't want to create any sorts of, you know, microbes or plants that'll, you know, create a different problem in the environment. Mm-hmm. So interesting things like that. And actually, the DOE is actually the original home of the Human Genome Project. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't know that, but that's where the interest in the genetics part came into, and genes and genomes in general. Mm-hmm. They originally cared about human genome because, hey, we have nuclear stuff. How might that radiation affect a human mm-hmm. at the genomic level? Well, to understand that, you need to have a genome, mm-hmm. an entire genome of the human. So that's where that idea originally came from. But now that's an NIH project, because that's more focused on health
yeah.
and developing new medicines and such for gene-based
yeah.
treatments. So, I mean, there's really interesting stuff that I did not know mm-hmm. until I interviewed to be a fellow in this office. Mm-hmm. So really fascinating, interesting ways that policy can affect how science is done, mm-hmm. and also drives science in new directions, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, the federal government, I think, until just recently, was the largest funder of basic sciences, mm-hmm. right? But, you know, where would all of those interesting technologies have come from? Like, everything in our phone started mm-hmm. probably from something at the DOE or something at NIST, you know, a small item that they were, you know, a scientist had an idea about and someone funded them to just try it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right? So coming up with a particular kind of semiconductor or a metal, materials for a transistor mm-hmm. or a cooling chip, you know, we're holding, you know, Apollo 50 just passed, right? So the 50th anniversary of the Apollo mission this past weekend. You know, we're holding more computing power in our hands mm-hmm. than they had to run that mission. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of insane when you think about that. Mm-hmm. You know, in 50 years, we're holding more computing power in our hands. And how did that happen? Through things like planning for the Apollo mission, trying mm-hmm. to create new technologies for, you know, batteries and mm-hmm. cars and just basic things like materials and, you know, how to make electrons flow more efficiently.
Yeah.
Like, photovoltaic solar panels existed for a long time. Mm-hmm. right? They were on our telescopes, or not telescopes, they were on our satellites like 50, 60 years ago. But now they're much cheaper, and now we can make them to be on our houses and buildings, and, you know, you have Tesla solar panel, you know, roof tiles.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's been really fascinating to learn how much the federal system has done for technology.
Yeah. So to speak to that, that's sort of the question I want to end on here, because you are a rich science history, and you are sort of in this juncture between policy and science, and myself with a science background, especially in today's society and current political climate, the propagation of like fake news and misinformation and, dare I say, ignorance is just so pervasive. And, you know, I kind of speak to myself. I, like, by default, just love investigating questions. Like, if I don't know a fact about whatever they're talking about in the Green New Deal, I'm going to go and investigate that. I love reading research papers just for fun, because, like, some nerd somewhere was like, I'm going to ask a question and answer it. And, like, that's my idea of fun. But
you might be, you know, Malaysian if. You might be South Asian if.
Right?
You're curious.
Right?
You read research papers for fun.
Like, it's so fun. Like, tangent, there's this great article, research paper, that is about how urban form and dance interact, especially in China. Like, if you ever watch a documentary about China, there's always, like, the public parks where, like, the aunties and uncles are, like, dancing and doing Tai Chi. It's about how... Big old tangent.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I'm curious sort of what your opinion is, and maybe some suggestions for, like, an average citizen that is not with a scientific background, that does not necessarily give a hoot about all of the nitty-gritty about how we're doing this experiment or, like, this up here, like, finding the middle ground of being able to do their own sort of research and find the information that can explain to them, why is the policy doing and what is the science that's making this policy happen? Mm-hmm. If that's not too...
That's a big question. So let me take that in two parts.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's first just get curious about the science part, right? Mm-hmm. So all of us have, you know, literally the power of the world in our hands, right? So I really encourage people, you know, for every third time that you click on a social media app on your phone, you know, make that fourth click to Wikipedia, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Wikipedia actually is a pretty brilliant resource because it's, you know, constantly checked by folks who love Wiki and care about Wiki and care about the information on Wiki, and they won't easily let garbage be up there. And even if there is, like, you can flag it yourself, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'd like to say that, you know, social media is great. I use social media too. But every third or after three times clicking on your social media app,
mm-hmm.
you know, click on something else. Click on Wikipedia and look up the next word that comes out of, you know, someone's, you know, mouth, whatever station you're watching,
mm-hmm.
right? And or some, you know, keep a running list of just interesting questions you have. Right. And every few days, just reflect on those questions. Just take a look at them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think just starting there, mm-hmm. just to redevelop your curiosity, redevelop your desire to know. I think Neil deGrasse Tyson said that, you know, we're all born curious. Kids are always putting stuff in their mouths and poking things. And, you know, this is why we have to, like, protect little babies from stuff, right? Because
yeah.
they stick their fingers in everything. And so it might be an electronic circuit, right?
Mm-hmm.
Electric circuit. I think we have to redevelop our curiosity just on the basic level. You know, if you don't know if you forgot how a lamp works, you know, if you forgot why do we use LEDs versus the old incandescent bulbs, just look it up, right?
Mm-hmm.
And just start there, right? Because by understanding a little bit about the science, for example, with LEDs and incandescent bulbs, you know, we had that weird scare a few years ago. People were like hoarding incandescent bulbs because they thought they weren't going to sell them anymore or some craziness.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's ridiculous. That's absolutely ridiculous. The reason incandescent bulbs just take up more energy and why LEDs take up much less energy can be easily understood. And even if you're not scared of your incandescent bulb running, you know, being taken away from you, mm-hmm. you care about your power bill, mm-hmm. right? And if you have a little bit of understanding of like, wow, that incandescent bulb gets so hot, that heat is nothing but your electricity turned into now a heat lamp, mm-hmm. right? And why would you want your electricity to be heating your house when it's supposed to be just lighting up the room so you can read your book? Mm-hmm. So that's why LEDs are great, because they're such a small amount of electricity, but create so much light. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what you want, right? And so simple things like that will help you understand like why the policy is that, hey, let's sell more LEDs. Let's try to make them less expensive than mm-hmm. incandescent, right? Not that incandescents are bad, but if you talk about it in terms of like saving people money, saving government buildings money, right? Mm-hmm. If you're spending less to run the building, then you can spend more money on interesting science, right? Mm-hmm. Or say, to return it to the public, right? Mm-hmm. So simple things like that kind of help you understand how to connect it back to policy. Mm-hmm. Some policy doesn't make sense because it's not evidence-based, but that's also something I have strong opinions on. I think that why scientists who choose to work in government are there is because they care about evidence directing policy, right? I'll just make a small plug for my podcast, right? Mm-hmm. Me and some of the other AAAS fellows, we have a little podcast called Beltway Science. So it's on purpose. I think that we have our initials being BS, because a lot of people think everything in the Beltway is BS, but we're a little bit different. So we actually try to talk about policy issues with the science lens, right? So we talk about data, and we talk about, you know, disentangling this misinformation, mm-hmm. right? As you pointed out, fake news and this ignorance that's happening in our communities. And we try to kind of leave a little bit of tidbits, a few more places you can look for mm-hmm. information. Yes, some of it has a political slant, but not so much. We usually try to stay away from politics. But, you know, our goal is just, hey, take a look at this policy from the science side. Let's see if it makes sense. Mm-hmm. And if we disagree, we think it doesn't make sense, let's say it. And we do try to tease the BS out of the Beltway, I guess. Mm-hmm. So it's fun. It's something I've definitely enjoyed being a fellow. And I think, you know, so the two tidbits I want to make sure I reiterate is every third click on a, you know, social media app, make your fourth click to Wikipedia and ask a question. Mm-hmm. And then the other is once you've asked that question and understand a couple of things, then you will inherently understand a little bit more of the policy, mm-hmm. why certain things are said, or you'll disagree with the policy and you'll mm-hmm. have real evidence as to why you disagree.
Yeah.
I think just start there. So just rekindle your curiosity.
I like that. I think that's a good thought to end on. Just stay curious.
Stay curious.
And keep asking those questions.
Yeah.
And thank you so much, Sujata, for joining me for this episode.
Thanks for having me.
If you would like to learn more about Sujata and her work or any of the things we've plugged in this episode, there will be links down in the description. The show would not be made possible without some amazing artists that have donated their time and effort. Thank you to Aaron Thomas for the album art for this show, and thank you to Rosie Ross for the use of our theme song. We come out with a new episode every other week. You can find more information at stemsandleaves.com. My name is Emmy. This has been Stems and Leaves. Thank you for listening.